Coming up on Boston Public Radio, half of Boston's 2013 high school valedictorians come from places like Cameroon, Haiti, and El Salvador. What does it say about kids from those places, and what does it say about kids from the USA? And speaking of questions, could you eat on $4.50 a day? People on food stamps do. We'll be joined by two top welfare officials who tried it for a week. We'll see how hungry they are, Marjorie.
Then Reverend Eugene Rivers joins us to tell us what young black women need to hear from their fathers. Emily Rooney debates a huge snub to our annual 4th of July celebrations. Famed food writer Raymond Sokolov tells us about 40 years in the food biz. And Adam Riley reports on what John Moderano, who killed 20 people, testified today at the Whitey Bulger trial. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio. Stay tuned. Jim Brady, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hey.
So the final debate between Ed Markey and Gabriel Gomez is here at WGBH tomorrow night with us to give their thoughts on that race with 8 days to go and on more political topics. Our Hillary Sargent, she's the woman behind ChartGirl.com, which Time Magazine just named one of the 50 best websites in America. Her most recent offering was Whitey Bulger's Boston, which was on Boston.com and ChartGirl.com. Hello there, Hillary Sargent.
Hello.
Welcome.
Congratulations. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
And also, we are joined by Scott Lehigh. He's a political columnist for the Boston Globe. Welcome back, Scott.
Welcome. Or thank you.
That's right. No, see, it's all
time had nothing to say about me.
Oh, well.
But they might.
That's
you never
okay.
know. Keep hope alive.
We love
there,
you
Scott.
Anyway. Anyway, Scott. So, as we've all documented, no one seems to be much interested in this race, but we're going to try to change that. We've got a GBH debate tomorrow night. It's not that close, but can Gabriel Gomez do anything to maybe get it back into the single digits?
He would have to change his outlook a little bit or his presentation a little bit. If I were he, you know what I'd say? I would say, look, try me for 2 years, and if you don't like me, or try me for a year and a half, you can vote me out next year. I will go down there and be a different kind of Republican for Massachusetts, and you've got a little trial period in this special, and I'll be up
it's
again.
It's a brilliant point. But for those who are saying, what are you talking about? It's a special election.
Yes.
The regular election to fill the slot is in November of next year.
So we could easily say that. Watch me for a year, and if I disappoint you, get rid of me. But I do not think this campaign has been strategically thought through.
Gomez.
I think Gabe is a nice guy, but I don't think the campaign has been as well thought through as it should have. I don't think his presentation about how he would be sort of a counterweight to the Tea Party Republicans has been as compelling as it should have. And I think he really needs to reassure people on that point that he won't be a Mitch McConnell clone to close the deal here. And it's
you know, Hillary Sargent, I've been obsessed with the business thing. For 9 years prior to Gomez running, he was at Advent International, his private equity firm. I asked him week after week about this thing. The Globe did a great piece the other day when they shut he shut his door in the face of the two reporters, Beth Daly and Stephanie Ebert. Do the public care about the details of this thing, or do they care about the fact that simply he had 9 years in the business community, private sector stuff is good, we need more of that in Congress?
I mean, I think the most fascinating thing about his time at Advent is the fact that the one deal he disclosed was Lululemon.
Right.
Which it seems like the one thing he needs right now is women's votes, and I don't know, in New York, Lululemon just went through a huge scandal when I think they had to pull back 50% of their yoga pants after it was discovered
that
they were see-through.
Yeah, that was so great.
And everybody, he may or may not have been involved in the sourcing of that fabric.
Maybe
I don't think we know.
They're bending over in yoga classes, and oh my God, it was an embarrassing situation.
We should say on the Lululemon front, while according to the Globe story, while that was the one activity, the company he was intimately involved in, on the website, the Advent International said he had nothing to do with, or did, he wasn't one of the leaders on that effort,
well,
at least.
I mean, I think that's the other question is, would you rather have someone that was really good at a job that you don't like, or someone that wasn't that good at a job you don't
meaning
like?
Meaning Markey versus Gomez. You know, speaking of that, I read your column after you went to Springfield for the last debate. You know, you basically say Ed Markey didn't do so well. And then in the next paragraph, here's what you say. He was, in other words, what he is, Steady Eddie, a man with an unflappable manner, a master of the issues, and an impressive record. I mean, is that your disparaging remark about Ed Markey?
That's a pretty good summation.
That is a very good summation. But
no,
I mean,
no, what I mean about Ed Markey is he is what he is. I would like to see some sort of Paul Sungesian thinking out of him, something that says, look, I'm not going to go down there and be another reflexively partisan Democrat. I am going to think anew about some of this stuff. This is not going to be the Ed Markey. I'm not just going to be a Truman Roosevelt New Deal Democrat. I am going to be, you know, part of the different gangs, the bipartisan gangs that try to get something done. I don't think you're going to see that kind of Ed Markey, but he's very good on, he's the guy knows legislation. He's had a lot to do with sort of shaping the current Massachusetts economy and biotech and the digital stuff. He's very smart and he's a master of the issue. So you have to respect him in many ways.
So your indictment is that he's not charismatic. That's essentially.
My indictment is that he's not willing to sort of think in the center
the
where a lot of modern politics.
But I think that's what your impression of him is. That he is a totally reflexive Democrat. I mean, he's going to go right back down there and do the same thing everybody else does in the whole delegation.
Which is exactly where the people of Massachusetts are. It may not sell in the Democratic Party in the heartland. You know, one of the things Hillary Sargent...
they're not always there, Jim, as
what's
we
that?
Know. They're not always
well,
there.
Let's talk about where they are. It seems to me, and this is not an anti-Gomez statement at all, I can't think, and either of you can answer this, but starting with Hillary, he is pro-life, even though this is Gabriel Gomez. He says, and we've had long debates about this, he wouldn't do anything to change Roe v. Wade, but he's sort of nebulous on the whole Stupak and the other amendments to that would affect abortion. And he is anti an assault weapons ban. And while Scott wrote the other day, Scott Lehi wrote, that's not even an issue because it's not before Congress. It's symbolically huge. I guess my question is this, Hillary. Can anybody who's pro-life and anti-assault weapon ban ever win a statewide race in Massachusetts? My contention is you could be Jesus Christ and not win that race.
I mean, I don't really think that's what it is. I think he's running against himself. I mean, I don't think he's really running against Ed Markey. I think Ed Markey is the default person you vote for if you don't. If something doesn't come out that makes you want to vote for Gabriel Gomez. I mean, I don't – that's
what
the
Bill Poll shows,
it.
By the way, that a lot of people are just voting for Markey because they vote for Democrats who are running for office.
But my biggest problem with Gabriel Gomez is he doesn't even want to be a senator. I mean, he seems
what
to me
that
– he said, I don't really want to be a senator. I just feel the need to serve. And I don't – you know, he seems to approach this as sort of, well, I went to Harvard Business School and then I was private equity and then, well – this
whoops,
is a logical
a
next
big,
step.
You left
yeah.
a big one out.
Well, also,
he's a Navy SEAL.
Navy
you don't
SEAL.
Know that?
No, I know that, but I'm saying.
You didn't know that, Scott. Did you know he's a Navy SEAL?
You know, I heard rumors
yeah,
he might
SEAL.
Be a Navy
trust
SEAL.
Me, he's
you know
a Navy
what,
SEAL.
I think you hit the nail on the head. You look at this guy and these debates so far. Maybe it'll be different tomorrow at GBH, but so far you look at this guy and you think, why doesn't a guy that went to Harvard Business School seem a little bit smarter than this? Why does he have to keep telling me over and over again that he's a Navy SEAL, Navy SEAL, Navy SEAL, Navy SEAL? Okay, we all know that. Enough already. I don't have confidence in the guy. And when you look at the performance of Scott Brown, who people did elect statewide, he was a much more effective debater against Martha Coakley.
Well, he was a legislator for decades.
Can
by
I
the
say,
way.
Marjorie
I like Gabe much more than Scott Brown. He's personable. He doesn't skitter away like a scared chipmunk from the press the way Scott Brown frequently did from lots of reporters
excuse
who
me,
want
excuse me.
I know he was good
did
with you.
See,
I know.
No, I'm not talking about good with
me.
Well,
excuse
guys, me.
But
no,
the
wait,
guy,
no,
you
Jim
guy was scared
Scott,
of his own shadow.
Hold on.
What?
Jim, but he was so
come
much
on.
More handsome.
I know Jim likes him, but
well, he was much more handsome.
Yeah, I think that's the other real
there's
issue.
There's no sex appeal
exactly.
to Gabriel Gomez. Scott Brown is really sexy, and somehow.
And that's
even
disturbing. When
it
someone's
is.
That good looking and not sexy,
okay.
I think women are turned off by that.
Hillary,
are you serious about that?
Yes.
Well, you would know this.
Would I joke
my
about
column,
this?
Jim. I wrote about this couple
simmering
of weeks ago.
Simmering sexiness, Marjorie wrote.
Simmering
right.
sexiness of Scott Brown, and none.
Gabriel Gomez has no aura.
Can we get back to one of the things you
yeah.
said? Did you
sure.
just watch the video that was attached? You didn't, and you're probably going to be in trouble back at the Globe.
What?
When Beth Daly and Stephanie Eber
yes,
tried to ask
yeah.
him,
yeah.
do you see what his response was? Did you send more, I'm paraphrasing, more
yeah.
jobs to
yeah.
China than you created here? He shut the car
yeah.
door in their face.
Well,
what kind
not,
of answer is that?
That's not a good move.
But give him a break. He doesn't even want to be the senator. Do you
those
know what I mean?
Those
are
two tough
exactly.
reporters.
Can
yeah.
I tell you, since
but in general, I will say this. You can go out. He has regular press avails after his events. You can talk to him.
Gomez, you're talking about.
Yes, you can. And that was, I mean, if I were he, that was an unfortunate thing. But you can get him. You can talk to him as a reporter, as a general rule. That was not true,
He's been a regular. In all fairness,
excuse
up until
me.
Recently,
excuse
he's been
me.
A regular here.
I think Hillary
say.
And I have hit the nail on the head
what
here.
What is that?
Well, you were like almost every man in Massachusetts madly in love with Scott Brown. It was really embarrassing.
I wouldn't say it was
Scott
madly
Brown
in
would
love
text
with Scott
him.
Brown.
No, I think Jim that would
right.
glow.
He had a bromance.
He had
him.
A bromance yeah. going on, and a lot of men did. If they wanted to be Scott mm-hmm. Brown, they wished yeah. they were
the
Scott Brown.
The late night tweets.
Yes.
I mean, what, there was nothing not to love about
it. I wasn't on Twitter then, but thank you very much.
There is none of that.
But that,
with
I think that's
Gomez.
What Gabe could do this week. Yeah. I mean, he could do some late night drunk tweeting, go by Gabe instead of Gabriel.
That's right.
I think that would really bring the women
in
out.
In fairness to Gabe, he is of one great commercial. We're going to play a little piece of this. I don't know. Is this a web spot or is this a TV spot? I'm not sure. Here's a piece of a Gomez thing that uses humor, which I think is grossly underutilized in politics. Listen to this.
Gabriel Gomez is a very bad man. He kills old people. He hates women. He even leaves the toilet seat up. That's just ridiculous.
Congressman Markey must think we're stupid. Markey's everything that's wrong with Congress. 37 years of pay raises, bounce checks, taking millions from people he regulates. It's about trust.
Now, Scott Lehigh doesn't like that. You can't see Scott's face. I can. The reason you don't like it, because it's not a serious explanation of his
funny.
Political positions. It is funny.
I just don't like the toilet part. Honestly, I'm someone who doesn't like that kind of
so
humor.
So what does he do? We didn't ask you this, Hillary, Sergeant. On a serious note, his last best shot is tomorrow night here at GBH. It's a final debate. I assume a decent number of people are going to watch this thing, because it is the final debate. What do you do, seriously, if you're Gabriel Gomez?
I don't really think there probably is that much he can do. I just think he has to hope that Markey does something really stupid.
Markey won't. I mean, Markey doesn't. He's
steady,
he's steady
Eddie.
He won't.
That's right.
I read that in your column. Yeah. He's steady Eddie. Well, you know, can I raise another issue that relates to this? This has been an issue with me for decades. This issue, polling. The Globe comes out with a poll on Sunday, 9 days before the election, showing him, depending on what the screen is, a 13 or an 11-point lead. Don't you think that polling that close to elections, and it's not everybody does this. I'm not saying it's the Globe. Is bad for small d democracy. Don't you think it basically says to the voter, this race is over. And so if you want to go out, fine. But essentially, this race is over. What's the value of having a poll, Scott Lehigh, with 9 days to go?
I think you look at a race that's 10 or 11 points 9 days out, you say, hey, that really could go either way. I mean, there's margin of error in the poll, let's not forget, of 4.3 or 5. And that reposes on either number. So Gabe's number could be 5 higher, could be 5 lower. Markey could be 5 higher, could be 5 lower. It's not just the spread. We always treat it as though it's the spread between
them. Who was the last major politician who won a race where he or she was 13 points down with 9 days to go?
Oh man, I'd have to. Go back to the archives. No, you really could. I mean, that's not an
unwinnable
race.
What value, even if you're right, what public purpose does polling do within, let's say, 2 weeks of an election?
It gives people an idea where the race is. I think it interests some people. As much as people say, oh, we don't like horses, or we don't like polls, and as much as politicians say, I never look at polls, everyone is interested in a poll. They like to see what other people think. It's newsworthy, and it's not as though it's the day before the vote, and we're saying, hey, guys, this thing is over. We're saying, look, a week and a couple days out, this thing is, you know, it's Markey's got a lead, but it's not a huge lead. It's a barely a double-digit lead.
So Hillary Sergeant, did you find Scott Lehigh's argument to be a compelling one?
I mean, I don't read polling stories ever, really, so I don't worry too much that they're going to have a big impact this far out. I mean, I'm confused about the fact that there are still people who are undecided. I think people are undecided as to whether they're going to vote. I can't imagine they're really undecided as to who they're going to vote for. I mean, it's not that. It seems like it's a pretty easy decision to make one way or another. The decision is, oh, it's raining, I'm not going to vote, or I have other
things.
Well,
I'm going to take one more shot with you, Marjorie.
What's that, Jim?
What did you do when you woke up every single morning for a month before the presidential election last night? What was the first thing you did every day after you brushed your teeth?
I was obsessed with I looked at the guy from the New York Times.
Nate Silver, RealClearPolitics.com.
Nate Silver, that's right. Because I was obsessed with the Romney-Obama race, people thinking that Romney was going to run away with the whole thing. And I was obsessed before that with Hillary versus Obama. So,
but did it have any impact any of those days of whether you were going to go vote or who you were going to vote for? Right.
No.
So that's my
point.
The people who read those stories are the people that already care about it and have already decided who they're going to vote for and whether they're going to vote.
I do think if the polls show that it's like 20 points or 15 points, I think you feel like, okay, it's done. What's the point? Am I going to vote if you're voting for the underdog? That's the only thing I think is effective about it. I will say one thing about this, Markey, though, and you've pointed this out in your columns. When you listen to him, he does rattle off, you know, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. I mean, he really does drown you in all his details, and poor Gomez can't do
and
that.
You just say, fine, Ed, I'll vote for you. Leave me alone.
That voice, by the way, is Hillary Sargent. She's the woman behind ChartGirl.com. The most recent is one on Whitey Bulger. The other voice is Scott Lehigh, political columnist for The Globe. What were we going to say, Scott?
I don't remember. I was going to say, I do think that Gomez should have, before he did this race, he should have sat down and really come up with a more compelling idea of what he's about, because he has a few data points, a few issues, but it's mainly biographical. And yeah. I think you're asking people to make a big investment. We had him in the other day in the Globe and saying, well, what's your philosophy? What informs? He's saying, well, I'll call him as I see him. Yes, but what philosophy informs the way you will see them?
Well, I won't call philosophy, but I think his basic message is the message that you said he should express 15 minutes ago by saying, give me a year and a half and see how I do. His basic message is, without saying these words exactly, everybody hates Congress. In fact, I think the approval rating the other day was the lowest it's ever been. This guy has been there for 37 years. Even if you think he's done good things individually, he hasn't been able to fix the dysfunction of this institution. Give me a chance. Isn't that his basic message? It is, right?
We haven't said that, though.
Well, he's mentioned the 37-year thing as much as he
says. But he hasn't said, give me a chance for a year and a half. It's very
clever.
No, that
part is actually a good one. I like that thing.
Yeah, I think that would be fun marketing, and people could look at it and say, yeah, what the heck? I will have another vote on him. If I don't like him, I can vote for someone else and vote him out. And Markey's message, you know, the other side of it is you vote for this guy and it's going to encourage the Tea Party Republicans that they can win even in Massachusetts. They can stall everything and they're just going to try to wait out Obama. So it really should be, there are some meta messages and there should be some issue messages. But I think they have not crafted either one all that well.
They being the Gomez campaign.
The Gomez campaign, yeah. I mean, Markey is what he is, and you can see if you've got a lead, you sort of play safe ball. You take the three or four issues that you think are important, that are dividing issues, and where the people are on your side, most of the electorate, and you drive them. That's what Markey's done.
Who is Gomez? Who is Gomez's campaign? The same people who is it? Eric, for instance?
Well, some of the people from
some of them. I got to say, it's not exactly the same. Will Ritter, who's a Romney guy's there, and he's very good.
Uh-huh. Press person,
yeah. I think, as I understand it, Gail, I can never pronounce her last name, Gitchko, I think is doing some consulting.
She
I think Eric is working on the, the super PAC thing.
Okay.
And Lenny, another Romney guy is there as the manager. So I got to say, I don't have the chart in front of me.
Okay, so it's a lot of Romney.
Speaking of charts.
Well, it's overlap.
Speaking of charts, can we talk? You are chart girl.
She is chart girl. Whitey Bulger chart girl thing is really,
wasn't
I love
it brilliant?
That. All the pictures. Yes, all the pictures of all the different places around town.
Well, speaking of charts, you've also done a chart on Tamerlan Tsarnaev. You did a chart on the Marathon Bombings. That's one I want to switch to for a minute because it's an area that you focus a lot on. In the last couple of weeks, the following two things have happened. Robert Mueller, the outgoing head of the FBI, has testified in front of Congress. And while he hasn't said, well, let's hear a little bit of Mueller in front of Congress. I think it was last Thursday or Friday. It's coming.
Is there something that needs to be corrected? Has it been corrected? Is there a law that needs to be changed?
Yes. No, it does not need law. It requires a correction to our procedures, which we've done, to assure that every such notice has a recorded record. It cannot be done informally. Somebody talking across the table.
Satisfied. Thank you, sir.
I should have said that's Congressman Steve Cohen, the first and the last guy, asking Mueller about intelligence breakdowns prior to the marathon. Well, he went out of his way to say, well, the Russians think we could have prevented this. I'm not sure I agree with him. Had we cooperated better? Bill Keating, congressman from the South Shore, came back from Russia a couple of weeks ago, said the same thing, and then he's gone basically silent. We haven't heard from him since. Why is everybody so reluctant to discuss the issue of whether or not had intelligence agencies cooperated better, had the FBI pursued or stayed on top of Tamerlan Tsarnaev after that first interview not the first interview anymore. Apparently they spoke to him twice before, sometime in the summer of 2011. Why is there not enough, at least in my opinion, more discussion about whether or not this thing could have been prevented? Why?
Well, I mean, I think part of the problem with Tamerlan Tsarnaev is that he doesn't fit the mold of every homegrown terrorist. There's sort of a normal American kid aspect to him. And my guess is that if you look back at what they knew, that they probably shouldn't have caught him and that they probably did look into it. And maybe there wasn't enough information sharing.
Wait a second. How can you say when Mueller admitted the other day, the first time I had heard, I think it was the other day, that they had two prior pieces of information or context, and he wouldn't explain what those were with the older Tsarnaev. Two other contacts, plus the discussion.
But he said they were non-terrorism related.
What were they related to?
Well, I don't know, but I mean, we could look up your name and find out that if you did something tomorrow, we might find out that over the years, the FBI has looked at you 20 times in the past.
But tell us that. But
I'm not sure that.
They've seen you at Whole Foods a lot.
I saw you at Whole Foods. But see, my attitude about this, Scott.
Can I say, I'm with you, Jim. I feel like the FBI, once again, dropped the ball in a monumental way, and I feel like people are just tiptoeing around it.
And are they tiptoeing?
I really
because
don't know
we're unpatriotic. We're not Boston
not,
strong
you
know, if we do it. What is
maybe there is some of that. You know, I thought there was an awful lot of these are our heroes, the first responders stuff. Maybe a little too much of that intimidated people. But
I'm much more disturbed by what the FBI or what. You know, what investigators didn't do in terms of this Waltham murder than I am in terms of, I mean, there's only one thing you can distinctly say.
The triple murder on the 10th anniversary of September 11th, yeah. Which has not been solved.
And also,
Wait, finish your thought. The guy in
Orlando,
we still don't know
why he was shot, if it's true that he was shot 6 or 7 times, as his father said. We still have no explanation.
Right.
In fact, the medical examiner hasn't even released the autopsy. How long ago was he killed?
We really need a big probe of this. And I mean, it's not as though we all have reposed endless confidence in the FBI. We've watched them before. And we've watched them screw things up to a fairly well. We know that they are.
But I don't even think it's just the FBI. I mean, I think if you look back, if Tamerlan Tsarnaev really committed that murder in Waltham, then there's only one thing you can definitely say, which is that if they had properly investigated that the Marathon bombing wouldn't occur.
Yes.
You don't even have to really look at, you know, the Russia piece. And the Russia piece is confusing because I think there's some thinking in some circles that after the fact to embarrass the U.S. government that Russia might maybe make it seem as though they had given a little bit more information than they actually gave. And I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility.
Yeah, but Hillary Sargent, you just said two things. You said, one, this is a truism. If Tamerlan Tsarnaev was actually involved in the Waltham triple murders, as the FBI is suggesting, and they say Todashev...
But the FBI didn't investigate that.
And if they had solved it within whatever it was, 15 months, then there wouldn't be 4 dead people and 260 injured, maimed, whatever. And number two, at least fill in the blanks, FBI, about those additional interviews. Tell us why you...
I completely agree with that.
Mueller told us the other day they had an expert interviewer in that mid-summer of 2011 thing. But why can't we know more?
And well, we should.
My position is whenever they don't tell us, I don't care who they are, whether it's Tim Murray and his cell phone records or the FBI, whenever they don't fill in the blanks, it's because the blanks are going to be damaging to their cause.
Can I make a further point?
Yeah.
Let's just say that they shouldn't have known beforehand and shouldn't have maybe interviewed him, shouldn't have taken a closer look. Once you have the actual bombing, I mean, what they did to flush this guy out was they released the pictures. What if they had gone and said, all right, who do we have? Who is this a picture of? Who do we have that might be this person and interview him? Then Sean Collier wouldn't have been. Then these guys wouldn't have started to run.
MBTA cop who was shot in Watertown.
Sean Collier was the MIT cop who was killed.
He
wouldn't be dead, and Richard Donahue probably wouldn't have been shot. They might have been able to get them
but
a different way.
But I think it's also that it's not just an unwillingness to go after the FBI. I think there's an unwillingness to look more closely at what, say, the Waltham Police Department did, the Watertown Police Department, the Massachusetts State Police. And that's really the whole Boston Strong thing. Doesn't involve asking more questions there.
You're saying it's because it would fly in the face of this notion that we all, particularly law enforcement first responders, were so they did incredible
and they were
work.
And so to look back at how they performed on September 12th, 2011 seems a little, you know,
post-Waltham murders.
Right.
We're talking with Boston Globe columnist Scott Lehigh and Hillary Sargent, the woman behind ChartGirl.com. I believe Hillary Sargent, the woman behind ChartGirl.com, you had a scoop of your own right around the marathon involving my colleague over here.
Oh, I did.
Mr. Browdy. Please tell us.
Well, I'm not sure if it was a scoop, but I was making a chart looking at the news coverage of the marathon, and I came across something indicating that Brian Williams, I didn't listen to a lot of the coverage on the day of because I have a 2-year-old. In hindsight, thank God I didn't because of what Jim said. But
that's right.
Jim was caught.
She would have been in therapy.
Cursing on the air.
Wasn't cursing. It was expressing.
He was cursing. And when I heard it, I thought it was going to be a real mystery that I would have to solve. But because I worked at the Globe Statehouse Bureau 10 years ago for a year, I recognize Jim Browdy's voice from his
Thanks
many
for sharing
phone
that,
calls.
By the way. I really appreciate that. It was a brief...
And I wrote something very nice on the chart.
You did.
That...
Okay, fine.
He sort of had a meltdown on the set.
Hey, can we...
No, I think it was a good meltdown. I think it was the meltdown everyone wanted to hear.
Really, it was?
Was it a Dan Ratherian meltdown?
No, it was not.
I thought it was a Bill O'Reillyan meltdown.
We'll do it live. No,
it was a charming meltdown.
In any case, before you guys go, a little bit later, we're going to be joined by the Secretary of Health and Human Services of Massachusetts and the new head of welfare, Department of Transitional Assistance. They both did the food stamp diet. You know what this thing is? Legislators, yes. Congresspeople, $4.50 a day to show what it's like for people who exist solely on food stamps. Could you do four? I'm serious, Scott Lehigh. Could you do $4.50 a day, $31.50 a week?
No.
I've seen Scott eat on a daily basis. There's absolutely no way he could do that.
Could you do it? You're a little smaller than Scott Lehigh. Could you really do $4.50 a day? Are you not sure? When you hear those numbers, we're going to say this to them.
I mean, I'm not saying it would be pleasant or that it's easy, but I think something like that to do for 3 or 4 days to say that you've experienced the idea that you can experience what someone who has no choice by just trying it out for a few days to me is a little bit absurd, although I think it's a great thing to do. I think Cory Booker, when he was doing this a year
Mayor
ago, maybe tweeted about his experience doing it, and I think it was fascinating.
But what did he say? I don't even know what he said.
Well, he wrote a lot about – he would write a lot about what he bought at the grocery store and about, you know, looking for things on sale. And I think trying – he did it for a longer period of time, though. It wasn't just a few days. But I think it's a great thing to do.
$31.50 a week is the amount of money if it's food stamps only.
You can't get very far. You have to put like 2 little leaves of lettuce on your sandwich and 1/4 of a tomato or something like that.
Right, and I think the key is to do it in a healthy way if you're, you know, feeding kids or a big family or something.
You notice Hillary Sargent's response took 2 minutes. Scott Lehigh's response was no. That's all he had to say. I mean, that sort of sums it up. Scott Lehigh from the Boston Globe. Hillary Sargent, chartgirl.com. Thanks so much, you guys. Really appreciate your time.
Okay, kids from other countries who have so much stacked against them are almost outperforming their American-born peers in academics. A look at our education system in Boston is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie. And here is a little quiz for you, Marjorie. I'm going to list a bunch of countries, and you tell me what they have in common. Is that
okay,
a deal?
Okay, I'm ready.
Cameroon, Nigeria, Bangladesh, Haiti, El Salvador, Lebanon, Dominican Republic, Colombia, Vietnam, Cape Verde Islands, and Morocco. What do they have in common?
Well, it's not really a fair quiz, since I did read the story. Those are the countries that some of the valedictorians from Boston Public High Schools come from.
Close to half of the 44 valedictorians at Boston's high schools in 2013 were born in other countries. A decent number of them didn't even speak English when they were brought to this country. So we want to know, what do these numbers, and by the way, it's been this way off and on for almost as long as I can remember.
For ages.
Ages. What does this say about these kids who were brought up in, or at least born in other countries, and their families? And what does it say about kids who were born here in the USA? Our number is 877-301-897. I love this story. I don't know why it is. Every year, I texted yesterday, I say you got to look at the valedictorian thing. The Globe, to their credit, they have a picture of each of the kids. They say they're born. There's a quote next to each of them, right, and what college they're going to go to.
Yeah.
It's really terrific. 4 from Vietnam, 4 from the Dominican Republic, 2 from El Salvador, 2 from Haiti, 2 from Cape Verde Islands, 1 from Morocco, Colombia, Lebanon, Bangladesh, Nigeria, and Cameroon. It's a powerful statement about something. What do you think it says?
Well, I think it says that they're probably working harder than our little spoiled Americans who are home playing, you know, video games all day long and have the, you know, the guilty parents doing too much for them. I mean, this is a grandiose statement, I know.
Make it.
But I remember a couple of years ago, it would have been longer than that, maybe even a decade ago, 2 of the kids, they were twins, and they come over from Cambodia, from the killing fields in
and
Cambodia.
Spoke no English, if I remember correct.
Yes, and sometimes they're boat people, and you know this. I mean, you may know this in your own lives if your kids are friends with people that come from other countries. There is sort of a new immigrant mentality where kids work really, really hard. They don't seem to feel that they're being asked too much when their parents also ask them to help around the house. We talked about this, you know, with kids doing chores and kids working for their money and kids having to work for the things they want and kids having to work in school as well. We've gotten a little softer, I think.
I don't know if it's just so. I think it also speaks to how education is valued in some parts of the world as opposed to how it's valued here. My guess is that in almost all these families, and again, this is a grandiose statement like yours, the consensus is there's nothing that is more important than having a high-quality education and doing well in school. That's not the perspective.
What they think about education in Bangladesh?
I don't know what they think. I think
exactly.
What I'm saying is the outcomes say something, don't they? When 50% of the valedictorians were born in other countries in Boston high schools, that's pretty powerful stuff. What's your take on why these numbers are what they are? And as Marjorie has said to me repeatedly, and I just mentioned to you, these numbers have been roughly the same for years and years and years. 877-301-8897. You know what I also love?
What?
And maybe this is too grand a statement, too. Don't you think that that numbers like this should have some impact on the immigration debate in Washington?
Well, that's the thing. That's the thing. I mean, obviously, these kids have really worked their behinds off to get to be valedictorians of their high school class.
I don't think they're aberrational either.
And the terrible thing is, if they're not already citizens, I mean, this is part of the DREAM Act argument. If they're not already citizens, I don't know how many are and how many aren't.
I don't know. We
could possibly lose these people after they get out of college, or they may have difficulty getting loans to go to college because they're not eligible for the same sort of things American citizens are. So it's time to give kids that are really excelling in school like this a break, staying here.
I didn't look at this, but did you not say this morning the vast majority of the 44 that you looked at, anecdotally, I admit, you didn't do a formal calculation, most of them are staying in Massachusetts to go to college, right? Is that?
Yeah, a lot of them are going. There's a kid from the Dominican Republic who's going to MIT, so obviously she's really smart. A lot of them are going to Boston College, which is a really tough place to get into now. One from El Salvador, she's going to Bryn Mawr College, another really tough school to get into. I mean, these kids are really excelling, and
think about it. Language differences, cultural barriers. I mean, the whole host of things they're facing that the typical kid who's born in this country is not facing. So they have obstacles in addition.
Haven't you noticed this with your kids?
What's
Can you take out the garbage, sweetheart?
No.
Can you clear the table? Can you clean the kitchen? Oh, I have so much homework to do. You know, I think I think there is sort of, and I don't know if it's because mothers are working more and you feel a little bit more guilty than if you were stay-at-home mom. I don't know what it's about. But I've heard this my whole life raising children, is that parents fretting that we are too easy on our kids. And I think you don't see this. Well, I haven't interviewed these kids personally, but in my own life, I have not seen that same sort of attitude with kids I've known who've come from other countries.
The reason I'm laughing, we're speaking about what an impact this will have on the immigration debate in Washington. To see what Jeb Bush, former governor of Florida, possible presidential candidate, had to say about recent immigrants the other day.
What?
They're, quote, more fertile than Americans.
They're more fertile.
That is exactly.
Okay, so they're smarter, they work harder, and they're
more fertile. Exactly. 877-301-8970. What's your reaction on this list? Is there something in there that makes a statement about kids who come here from other countries, they're born elsewhere and come here? Maybe there isn't a statement. Maybe it's just it really gives you, I don't know what it is, it gives you a great feeling when you look at the thing.
Almost half of them.
You feel terrific.
Almost
yeah. 20
half
out of 44
of them are valedictorians. And if we had the individual stories, you'd find out that kids came here very recently in many cases, you know, 2 years ago, 4 years ago, and managed to not only learn English but excel in their high schools in such a short time. I mean, I think it's really great. Let's go to Gary from Webster. What do you think about this, Gary?
Hi. I was just saying that the results and the outcome of these kids is indicative and typical of who they are to start off with. They're probably far more courageous, ambitious, able, intelligent and determined than the typical person in their country, as were many of the immigrants who came here at the beginning of the 20th century.
Yeah, that's a great point.
One of which, if I may say this, one of which was my great-grandmother, who came here from Poland and had a burning zeal to make money, started her own business, and boasted in 1936, at the height of the Depression, she bought my grandfather at that time a Buick Roadmaster convertible.
That is a great story, Gary. That is great. Gary, thanks for the call.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, how traumatic and how much courage does it take to up and leave your home and your family and the place you lived your whole life and come to another country? I mean, I don't think I'd do very well if I left here and went to Bangladesh, Jim, or Haiti, or places that are really...
Or Rhode
really,
Island, or...
Yeah, I mean,
exactly.
I had enough trouble going on vacation to Italy, which is really a great place. You know what I'm saying? Let's go to Leslie in the car. What do you think, Leslie?
Well, I just want to say that my daughter used to teach at Cambridge Ridge and Lack, which has a very diverse population.
Where both of my daughters went to school, by the way. But go ahead, Leslie.
Oh, Well, I have to ask if she taught him and what their grades were. So.
That's right.
But she was saying that when she had to call parents in of the students of the type that you're talking about, all the family came in. It was a very bad reflection on the family. They all took it to heart and made the student do much better. Whereas if she had to call in somebody who was a professor's kid, they never even came in to discuss the problems with her. So it's a whole reflection upon the family when a student from those countries do poorly.
Huh. But I think it must be different depending on the country, right? Not every country. I mean, I have no idea what the attitude is in Vietnam toward education. I just don't know.
No, but you do read stories all the time. And Leslie, thanks for the call, about people about wanting to get to America. And when you get to America, what do you want? You want the best education and get the best college. I mean, education is seen correctly, and I think it should be seen in this country too. It doesn't matter where you were born. Is it sort of the pathway to whatever it is you're looking for? And it seems that, and again, this is anecdotal and maybe unfair, and maybe stereotypical, that it's valued a lot more by those who have to fight hard to get it, as opposed to kids who were born here who have expectations that it's all going to be there for them, and that's not there for these kids. Let's go to Jeannie in Chester, New Hampshire. You are next on Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hey, Jeannie.
Hey, great conversation. I married a guy from Greece 20 years ago.
A guy from Greece, go ahead.
He came over, didn't speak any English, came over at 13. Worked his butt off, learned the language, graduated with honors, went to architectural school. It took him about 6 years because he had to work full-time while going to school full-time. Now, in the 20 years we've been married, we've had 3 children. Not one of those 3 makes much effort at all. I can't tell you how many times I've pulled everything out of their rooms and said, that's it, till I see better grades. I just did it to my middle child, and he actually is the one of the 3 that makes a little bit of an effort. The other 2 I've really given up on. It's very disappointing.
So what's the moral of your family's story, would you say, Jeannie?
Well, you know, now that I look back on it, my husband, who always knew he wanted to be an architect, and he achieved his dream, which he says if he had stayed in Greece, he never would have been able to do. But when he was here, once he got that degree and we were married, he never reads. He watches television all the time, not a reader. I honestly wish I had married somebody who was more academically inclined.
Oh, no.
I just don't see it.
I hope he's not listening, Jeannie.
This was an incredibly heartwarming story until that point, Jeannie.
I'm so sorry. It's so frustrating. My oldest is 17. I had the conversation with him in the car yesterday. You're graduating in a year. He's going to travel for 6 months. And the thing is, he's not stupid, but he makes no effort. He's going to go to community college for 2 years because we can't afford 4 years. Then he's going to do another 2 and become a teacher, which I'm perfectly fine with. But I said, you know, don't think once you graduate that you're going to earn $30,000-$40,000 and you're not going to have any problems.
Well, Jeannie, maybe the next husband can help you out a little bit more.
Yeah.
Hey, Jeannie, we got to go. Thank you for a very honest story.
We have a real quick one I want to take. What's really that? Quick, because this is an anonymous teacher from the Boston Public Schools.
Oh, great. Good.
So go, anonymous teacher. What do you make of this? You're right in the thick of it.
Yes. I have a few relevant experiences with this. One is being a Boston Public School teacher. I can tell you that I think it's about half of the students in Boston Public Schools who originate from other countries.
Yep.
So that's one, I think, valid thing to think about in this whole debate.
I want to stop you there. The implication in your point is, well, they have 50% of the valedictorians, 50% of the students. Even if your numbers are right, what a lot of these kids have to overcome is far greater. I mean,
absolutely.
But finish the thought. I'm sorry.
I completely agree. Okay. And I think, well, that actually speaks to one of the other things I wanted to mention, is that a lot of research has been put in lately into what actual factors impact student success. And yes, socioeconomic factors and home factors are an enormous part of this, but also is this this undefinable concept of grit, that it is the grit and the perseverance of the student, regardless of socioeconomic status, regardless of family situation or what kind of school you go to, that has the biggest impact on student success. So I'd be curious to see if there are other cultures or if other cultures in the world do a better job at instilling that value in their children than we do as, you know, typical American.
I want you to know, as a student, I was totally grit-free. I want to make that clear.
That's a
great, I know exactly what you're talking
that
about.
That was a great point. Thank you so much for calling. That's a great way to end the discussion. My children must need more grit, Jim. That was my problem.
But,
that's,
you know, regardless
where I
of your take on this, Google the Globe story about the valedictorians and just look at the pictures of these 44 kids and read where they're from. And
I know,
read
it's
their
great.
It's really
inspiring.
It is
inspiring. Absolutely great.
Yeah, it is great.
Okay, up next, can you imagine spending only $4.50 on food a day? Most of you can spend that in a cup of coffee alone. Up next, we'll talk to two state officials who are halfway through the food stamp challenge. How hungry are they? That's next on 89.7 WGBH.
The ongoing debate over same-sex marriage sparks passion on both sides. Now a new documentary looks at the issue through the lens of the African-American experience.
This is the unfinished business of Black people being free.
We'll hear from the director of The New Black. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Skinner Auctioneers and Appraisers, presenting 20th Century Design at Auction on Saturday, June 22nd, featuring works by Tiffany, George Jensen, and George Nakashima. Online bidding available at SkinnerInc.com. And Butler Hospital, conducting a research study for depression requiring daily visits for 6 weeks involving a new form of brain stimulation. Information at 401-455-6537 or newdepressionstudy.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Rowdy and she is Marjorie Egan. So if food stamps funded your whole meal budget for the week, you'd have to eat on $4.50 per day. Well, some in Congress apparently think that's too much. Here to bring a little reality to the topic are two people who took the challenge, fed themselves apparently for a week on $31.50. They are Health and Human Services Secretary John Polonowicz. John, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for being here.
Glad to be here.
Stacey Monahan, formerly the interim, no longer the interim commissioner for the Department of Transitional Assistance. People call it the Welfare Department. Stacey, congratulations on your elevation. Good to see you.
Thank you very much.
Now, I think Stacey has brought us a $4.50 lunch in here, Jim. She's got a beautiful basket with bread and hummus.
Is that what you really did?
Yes, I actually baked my own bread and made my hummus to
so
try to stretch.
So tell us what your $4.50 day meal was.
Isn't that beautiful?
This is actually about $1.50
okay.
In products, maybe a little bit more than that. But yeah, it's been really challenging and eye-opening for me to know how much planning needs to go into a menu when you're on such a tight budget. And how you can reuse ingredients and really make things stretch a long way.
Secretary Polonowicz, how many, first of all, let's go step back a second. Of people who receive food stamps, I mean, some of them are low-wage workers and that sort of thing. How many people, for example, in Massachusetts are existing only on this $31.50 a week thing as their meal budget?
So right now we have about 880,000 people in the Commonwealth on food stamps. Of that, about 35% of them are children. Another 30% or so are the elderly, about 15% are disabled. So it's about 490-some-odd-thousand households. And of that, within those heads of households, about 40-45% of those people are actually working. So many of them are, you know, the working poor here in the Commonwealth.
But so at least to do the math in reverse, at least a couple hundred thousand people, according to those numbers, their sole meal budget is this food stamp thing. Is it $31.50 a week? Is that right?
There are people that it is their sole meal bucket budget. If they do work, the SNAP program from the feds require about 30% of what you earn be tallied against your food stamp budget.
So you lose part of the $31.50?
Yes.
Yikes. So why'd you do this?
This is why food pantries are running out of food all the time. You see these stories all the time where all over the place, in Boston, the suburbs, places where you wouldn't think there would be this food disaster, they can't keep the shelves stocked.
I run the annual food drive for the Boy Scouts in the Knox Trail Council for a number of years. And the need in all of our communities is so high. And right now, about 68% of the people on food stamps on the SNAP program are accessing food pantries. So we're relying on, you know, the kindness of others for about 68% of the people nationally that are on this program.
So I assume the bottom line here is that this is not enough money. Is that the bottom line?
So I would say, so I'm doing it with my family. So it's my wife and my daughter who are doing it. So we had about $94.50 for the week. We've right now got $6.24 left.
How many days do you have left?
We will finish on Wednesday night. Wednesday night at midnight, we will finish.
It is Monday, and you have $6 and how much left?
$6.24. So right now, 90% of the people who are on this benefit nationwide are out of their benefit by the 21st day of the month.
And so is this, Stacey Monahan, it's pretty obvious, but the reason you did this was obviously to highlight how difficult it is for low-income people to exist on this benefit that they're getting.
Yeah, absolutely, to raise awareness about what a modest grant it is and how difficult it is to live on.
Okay, I interrupted you when you started with the food thing, which is what. And by the way, if anybody of you want to talk to either the secretary or the commissioner, you can give us a buzz at 877-301-8970. What do you think about the food stamp program? What do you think about the effort that they're engaged in? So tell us, start with you, Stacey Monahan. You're $31.50. Like, how did you manage it? And how, are you hungry? And all those kind of things.
I'm doing okay, but I am concerned about running out of food. You know, I'm sort of in the last few days, and rationing the food has been something that's on your mind. It takes a tremendous amount of planning to be able to plan out a budget and to reuse, like I got a can of tomato sauce, which I made chili with and made pasta sauce with, you know, sort of to double up on things to really stretch it out.
Are you hungry? I don't mean that as a joke. Yeah. Alan Parker was here from Project Bread right before the Walk for Hunger, and she talked to, it's not the term is not hungry, but whatever it is, food
insecure.
Insecure, that sort of thing. Are you hungry most a decent amount of the time?
I'm not as full as I normally think I would be.
So how does that feel? I don't mean the physical feeling, but how is that? How
no,
does
it
that
is,
affect
it's
you?
Anxiety producing, I think. And to really be able to, I only have an apple left now for fruit for the rest of the week. So that to sort of figure out, I ate my banana today, I have one apple left. So to be able to figure that out, when I'm going to eat it.
Well, you know what the other thing is here? That, you know, if you are a single mother with two kids and you're working, I mean, you know, the reason people buy fast food all the time or people buy frozen food all the time is because they don't have time to plan and to cook. And the cooking is so time consuming, not to mention the cleaning. I mean, and then you got the kids running around trying to grab your legs and everything else. I mean, how do you really do this? It's almost impossible.
Secretary, go ahead, Secretary.
So I was just going to say, the interesting thing on that is, you know, the SNAP benefit can't actually be used for fast food, so
yep.
Or any prepared meals,
good.
Or for things like, you know, soap or toilet paper or anything like that. So it is really difficult, and it's even more difficult here. You know, there's four communities in Massachusetts, Lowell, Brockton, Fitchburg, and some community, you know, some of the Dorchester and Mattapan, which are considered food deserts. So, you know, I did my shopping out at a Save-A-Lot in Springfield, and you know, that's considered a food desert.
Explain that term for people.
So the food desert are locations and areas where the number of supermarkets per person is lower than the national average. So in those communities right now, there are about 30% fewer supermarkets per person. So if you can imagine, it's one thing. We did the rest of our shopping yesterday in Wegmans in Northborough. We live in Central Mass. But try to do that shopping at your local, you know, the local corner store where there may not be fruits, there may not be the kinds of vegetables, there may not be the choices. And a lot of what you can get is the highly processed,
yep,
fattening foods that are inexpensive. Tough to be eat nutritiously that way.
Okay, so it is 12:53 on whatever day. This is Monday. We'll start with you, Secretary Polonowicz. What have you eaten today?
So I had a two oatmeals, fast food oatmeals, and a cup of coffee this morning. We did splurge and buy a can of coffee, a can of generic coffee.
As part of your $31.50.
As part of the $31.50, right. This afternoon, I had some peanut butter and celery sticks, a lot of protein there, and some vegetables. And the tuna casserole that we had made yesterday that I had for dinner last night, and I had it again for lunch today.
Are you, or a safe question I asked Stacey Monahan, are either you or your wife, or you said one of your kid is, are any of them saying, I'm hungry, it just doesn't feel right?
So, you know, my wife and daughter are continuing
How
to
old's
do
the kid, by the way?
She's 19.
Okay, good.
She was thrilled about doing the program.
I'm sure she was.
home from college. Guess what?
So, go ahead. So, how are they reacting to this?
It's tough. I mean, they're continuing to do their boot camp. They're hungry. I think, as the commissioner indicated, you know, some of these choices are hard. You know, and, you know, do you have this now or do you have it later? I mean, I've lost 4 pounds already, and I'm not... You know,
heavy.
Really that
you're pretty thin.
With.
Yeah, so, you're pretty thin to begin with.
So I'm not. I haven't been hungry, but I think, as Stacy said, you know, I'm not really, you know, sated most of the time.
I'll state the obvious. The difference between you and people who are really doing this, you know, that if you make it through 7 days, you return to normalcy, and that's a pretty. So you say to yourself, I can steel myself. But for people who exist on this, the eighth day is the same as the seventh day and the sixth day and the fifth day. You know, I don't understand. I'm assuming, as somebody who used to lobby sort of in Washington and a little bit at the State House, Commissioner Monahan, that we read that there's proposed $20 billion cuts in this the food stamp program. I am guessing, and we're going to talk to you briefly before you go, too, about what you've been living through the last couple of weeks with some anecdotes about how dollars weren't spent properly. Is that what it's about? Is they get an example of, in Kansas, somebody misspent their food stamps or sold them illegally? What causes people in Congress to think that $31.50 is more than people need to exist on food-wise for a week?
I think a lot of it is just... raising awareness. I think a lot of people, it's shocking to them when you break it down to $31.50 a week to $1.50 a day. When you put it in concrete terms,
$4.50 a day.
I think that it makes it really much easier to sort of translate.
So you think it isn't malevolence? They just don't understand. They members of Congress, you don't want to say this. Is that why you're looking at me like that? Well, I asked Secretary Polonowicz. You're the boss. Can you say? I mean, what is the motivation? It isn't like. They're splurging. What's the motivation to cut this budget?
So I think, you know, that part of the issue and one of the reasons why myself and the commissioner have been so focused on the program integrity piece is I think it's been really easy to demonize the entire program because of the few people that are abusing it. Right now, the SNAP program has, in 2011, has a 3.8% error rate. 0.8 of that is for overpayments in SNAP. It's one of the most efficiently run programs out there. But the anecdotes about the individuals and what people are buying with their SNAP benefit, I think it creates this furor around this. The $20 billion cuts that are coming from the Ag Committee, which is actually $4 billion over the 10 years, more than what they had proposed last year. On the Senate side, they're looking at about $400 million a year. But in any event, those are big cuts. They're on top of a family of four is already going to see a $25 a month cut in their benefit on October 1st of this year because of the ERA money running out. I think it's, you know, I think we've fallen, you know, as with many things, we've fallen a lot to the anecdotes as opposed to what we're really doing, which is why the commissioner and I are doing this. And again, your point is exactly right. You know, what we're doing for a week in no way, you know, indicates how hard it is to actually do this on a day in, day out, a week in, week out basis. But the idea is, you know, as we're trying to advocate for the program and as we're trying to drive on the program integrity piece, these are really needed benefits for the 880-some-odd thousand people in the Commonwealth that use them.
The voice of Health and Human Services Secretary John Polonowicz. The other voice belongs to Stacy Monahan, the newly appointed commissioner for the Department of Transitional
Assistance. I'm so glad you brought up the whole anecdote issue because the Herald has done a million stories, and I work for the Herald, too, about problems with welfare. And you know, that's part of the reason you're here now is because when the public who's next door to someone, you know, that they're just getting by, they're working two or three jobs, and they see someone they think is cheating, it drives everybody nuts. And then there was all these you know, payments going to dead people and the overpayment in food stamps, actually, itself. So, and EBT, rather. Was it EBT or was it food stamps?
Food stamps.
Okay. So that has to end, right, to keep that integrity in the programs. People aren't saying we're getting ripped off here.
Right. I think when I was appointed, the governor and the secretary gave me a mandate to go into the department and do a real top-to-bottom review and make any changes that are necessary. And that's why in March we launched a 100-day plan to really get at sort of phase one of the rebuilding of the Department of Transitional Assistance. And there's a full commitment from this administration and from me personally to do whatever it takes to make sure that the public is assured that tax dollars are being spent as intended and appropriately, and to really restore credibility with the legislature that the department's operating efficiently.
You know, Secretary Polonowicz, the governor's going to be with us tomorrow noon, and I'm sure we'll bring this up with him. He's mentioned 99.9% of the EBT program is run efficiently and legally and properly. When the Suzanne Bump, I don't know if she had her on the radio, I had her on TV, mentioned this 1,164 dead people, you guys and the governor himself hit back pretty hard at Bump. My understanding is you've all come to a meeting of the minds now. Peace has been returned. Is that correct?
Well, we've absolutely come to a meeting of the minds. And at the end of the day, Jim, what we want is what the auditor wants.
Is she close to right on those numbers? Have you gotten to that point?
So she gave us the date. We had a sit down with our staff and her staff. We went through how they did their analysis. They provided us that information midweek last week. We're reviewing that information. We have all 1,164 to cross-reference, and then we're going through it.
I want to get back to one more thing you said. Now, I don't know if you can get into this, but I hope you can. The demonization issue that you raised. Last week, we were talking about the head of NSTAR, who makes his holdings, according to Globe, $80 million. And Marjorie and I were all up in arms. And I have to say, it wasn't like we were joined by zillions of people. But if it turns out one woman misuses, or 100 women, or 1,000 women misuse $50 each on food stamps, it's like we have to call it the National Guard kind of thing. Same thing with, I had a discussion where I can't remember, Tom Conroy, and I was working closely with you, a state representative. We have $2 billion in tax breaks in the state that go to corporations, which are never reviewed. I used to work in the tax business, never reviewed. Nobody cares about that. So what is it that causes people to be so obsessed with that neighbor that Marjorie talked about? We all agree you got to deal with it. That poor person who's, quote, stealing $50 as opposed to the business that has taken $30 million.
So I can't delve the minds of everyone, but I think one of the things that does make a difference is when people see it, or it's published in the, whatever, in the press, it's right there in front of them. The people that are making, the $80 million, not many people are hearing about that. But if they see somebody who's, trying to use an EBT card, in their neighborhood, it's right there in their face.
It's a visceral kind of thing.
Feeling that somebody's getting something that I'm not getting. Versus, they may not know, the heads of all the corporations who are, or their VPs or their exec VPs.
They're a different kind. The people getting the EBT benefit are like me. And as opposed to that executive.
There's a desperation there that you don't have among people that are millionaires. Let's put it that way.
And by the way, my understanding is what? A couple dozen, 19 members of Congress have joined in this thing that you two are doing. Is that right, Stacey Monahan?
That's right.
Including some, Jim McGovern's doing it again?
Yes, he's doing it again.
Anybody else doing it from Massachusetts or no? Do we know?
I think that's it from Massachusetts. There was a list on Twitter the other day of about 14, and I think... and Jamie Eldridge is doing it.
State Senator Jamie Eldridge,
right,
yeah.
Right. But at the federal level, I think the Congressman McGovern is the only one who's doing it.
So when is this over, on Wednesday?
Yes.
So you get
Wednesday
two more
night.
Days.
Two more.
Are you going to go out to,
I knew she was going to ask this.
Going to go for cheeseburgers at McDonald's Wednesday night? What's your plan?
So it's a great question. I think, as Stacey said, it's really been, trying to kind of figure out what the meals are and do the planning and do you have enough money and do I have enough left over. I'm actually looking forward to going to, probably on Thursday, because I don't finish until late Wednesday night, our local place in town, and having a nice glass of wine and a meal that I don't have to cook or have to figure out how to make all the ingredients for.
How about you, Stacey? What are you doing?
I think for me, I'm going to take away some of the lessons that I've learned this week and really incorporate them into my daily life. I don't ever bring my lunch, for example, and I'm going to really start to do that. I think that there's a lot of things that this has sort of taught me as a person, things that I can do better in my life. So I am going to continue that.
Did you always know how to bake bread, or is it something
you've
learned?
I learned.
It's not easy.
So, Commissioner Monahan, while you're going to reflect on this, Marjorie and I are going to go to the Capitol Grill, and we're going to reflect. No, we're actually not going to do that. Commissioner Monahan and Secretary Polonowicz, we really appreciate your time. Good luck with it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
We have been speaking with Health and Human Services Secretary John Polonowicz and Stacey Monahan, the new Commissioner of the Department of Transitional Assistance. And as we said, they are close to the end of their food stamp challenge, spending only $31.50 on groceries for the whole week. Thank you both very much for being here. When we come back, it's time for Open Mic with Reverend Eugene Rivers III. Stay tuned to get his take on Whitey Bulger and Father's Day. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Big data. That's the buzzword du jour, thanks to the NSA story. And you know what you need to be able to use big data?
The new wealth in the top 1%, to use the language of the Occupy movement. Within that, you'll always find some giant computer.
I'm Kai Ryssdal. Giant computers and your big data. What's it worth? Next time on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6 here on 89.7 WGBH.
We love our contributors. That means you. In Orchard Cove in Canton, an independent senior community, you can learn how to prepare smart foods from Legal Seafood chefs on Wednesday, June 26th at 1:30 p.m. More information at orchardcovelive.org. And the Museum of Science, where you can uncover a portal to ancient times at the new Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit. See what life was really like over 2,000 years ago. More information at mos.org.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. I should say, before we get to our open mic guest, we should be ashamed of ourselves. We just had two people here, Marjorie and I, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, the Commissioner of Transitional Assistance Department, Stacey Monahan. She is living on 3150. Her food, she says she's running low with 3 days to go. What do we do before we leave?
We
ask her if we can try the bread she baked and the hummus she made, and we're both eating it.
It was delicious.
Which reduces what she has left. In any case, joining us today, as he does every Monday on Open Mic, is the Reverend Eugene Rivers III. Reverend Rivers, it's good to see you.
It's great to see you.
That's
great. We just saw you looking Mount Rushmore-esque, if I do say so myself, in the Boston Herald in a piece that ran right before Father's Day about fathers and daughters and what fathers should be doing for their daughters and are not. What's that, Gene Rivers?
In the black community, we have a crisis where our girls are being sucked into all kinds of terrible crimes. In fact, just this past week, a couple of girls were on an MBTA bus and threw...
Bleach incident.
The bleach.
You should say, for people who
for the benefit of the folk that don't know, to show you how off the grid this is, there were some girls on a 28 bus on its way to Mattapan, I believe, who threw bleach on some innocent, absolutely innocent man.
Yeah, middle-aged guy.
Yeah,
just sitting there.
Just sitting there minding his business, praying to God that he could get home on that MBTA bus without being assaulted. And the girls took the bleach. It is insane.
Threw it in his face.
In his face. It is insane. And I've been, you know, as some of you may know, I've been saying this forever. I said, look, this stuff is getting worse and worse. And the public has to be engaged. First and foremost, the black community has to be engaged. The black politicians, the black female politicians, the black clergy, it's insane. Our madness is now the new normal in the black community. Now, that's the... And see, you know what's interesting about this? See, the marathon and the response from the larger community marathon was based on the legitimate, rational understanding that this will not be tolerated. The black community has got to step up and say that this madness, which is now the new normal, will not be tolerated.
I want to read one line from your Herald piece. It's a full page in the Herald. Was it on Friday? Yeah, yes. Friday before Father's Day. A Father's Day challenge is what it's called. We need to defend cities' daughters from violence. First, this is you writing. Black religious leaders must lead a process of repentance for our indifference, is the word used, to the suffering of our defenseless daughters. You know, the conventional wisdom, I think if you were to ask most people on the street, who are the people you protect most in your family? Is it your sons or your daughters? I think virtually everybody would say, it's the daughters. It's the girls. We go out of our way. So why is this assuming you're right, why is this happening?
There is something that is tragic that has to do with the collapse of black leadership, nationally and locally. The black leadership has permitted, on their watch, we've got all kinds of distinguished black politicians in this city, right? How is it? And this is the thing that my head explodes regarding. How do you let your daughters? Boys will be boys. They do what they do. But what kind of line have we crossed when it's okay to essentially execute black girls as they did on Harlem Street last summer.
Yep.
And then you have on the opposite end of this, black girls that go on a bus and throw bleach on a completely innocent person, and there is no collective outrage in the community that says, what the hell is going on?
But you say, well, the outrage should be a function, I believe you're saying, of the fact that these are girls.
Yes.
And essentially, and I'm putting words in your mouth, correct me if I'm wrong, that up until a certain point in time, whenever that was, there was a line that wasn't crossed. And the line was that neither the victims nor the perpetrators were girls.
That's
essentially
correct.
All the bad stuff that was going on.
Yeah, it was guys.
Was boys,
it was guys
and
stuff.
Boys on boys.
Boys being boys. That's right. Boys on boys. Right.
But I am sure in pulpits all across Dorchester and Mattapan yesterday, people were talking, I hope, about some of this stuff, and that people are talking about, I don't know, are the black politicians, the city councilors, I mean, Tito Jackson, Charlotte Gola Ritchie that's running for mayor, are they not talking about this?
No, amazingly, I didn't hear from Tito Jackson. I didn't hear from the other city council?
Charles Yancey?
Didn't hear from Charles Yancey. I didn't. What's the, well, the Ayanna Presley?
Ayanna Presley.
What's the Ayanna Presley?
She's a woman on the city council.
Black woman on the city council. This presumably would be her issue. I'm astounded by the silence in the black community regarding what's happening to your daughters. There is some moral and cultural decay when this madness is the new normal. And that's just simply indisputable.
So when was this line crossed and why? The line you described. When did it happen that the boundaries were crossed vis-a-vis girls?
I think in the last 15 years.
Why?
Because of a failure of black leadership, which has to do with parenting. We went from two-parent households in the black community to single-parent households, to no-parent households. Functionally, there's nobody in charge. And so you have a situation where the grandmother is 35, mom is 15.
Yeah.
Right? And Junebug or Crystal is 2 or 3. And these young people are raised in this completely anomic, anarchic environment, and no one says, we're not going to take this. I was talking to a couple of black police officers, and they said, we've got, Moynihan talked about the Tangela pathology and got run out of town in 1965. We have...
Daniel Patrick Moynihan.
We now have an environment where this madness is accepted as a new normal among the leadership. And the reason that I wrote the article, I said, look, I really don't need... this kind of exposure. But I cannot live with the idea that black girls get murdered, black girls get pulled into what they get pulled into, and there is no outreach.
Yeah, but Gene Rivers, if I may, when you've said about five times now.
I know.
I'm not criticizing you.
No,
the
my
leaders,
bag,
the black leaders are saying, accepting this is the new normal. They're not accepting anything. I assume they haven't figured out a way out of this. It isn't like they're saying to themselves, well, listen, there are a lot of black women and girls who are victims. There are a lot of black women and girls who are either set-up girls or perpetrators or that sort of thing. So we're okay with that because it's a new normal. They're not okay with it either. They just don't know how to fix it. Isn't that a fairer statement than what you're saying?
I'm not sure that's true.
You're acting as if they don't care.
I'm not going to say that, but I don't know, to be perfectly honest. I live in the black community. Literally, I walk the streets of the neighborhoods, and I'm astounded. And I'm saying, dude, really? We're going to let this happen?
It's become one thing that has become the new normal everywhere, and it's black, white, rich, poor, is nobody gets married. I mean, there was a whole piece yesterday in the Boston Globe about this couple that was injured in the marathon. Lovely young couple, and she discovers she's pregnant, and they're all excited. No mention of getting married. I mean, at least if you get married, you can go after the father for child support when he takes off like 6 months later.
Hello.
And this poor woman is not left alone. And you see these stories in the paper all the time. It's become a joke now, the New Year's Eve babies. The New Year's Eve babies are almost never married. Everybody's like with their boyfriend and stuff like that. So no one wants to criticize that in the white community. No one wants to criticize that in the black community.
Well, let me give you one person who's criticizing some part of it, maybe not those details. I listen, talk about sickness. Every Saturday I listen to the president's radio address and the responsive radio address from the Republican Party. This week the Republicans talked about some substantive issue. I think it was, immigration or something. Barack Obama's thing was all about fathers. And once again, we talked last week. I mean, the guy, maybe he doesn't have the solutions. I don't know a president who has focused as much on the responsibility of fathers
as this guy. Because his father left him.
Of course that's why, but yeah. I'm saying he has dedicated a decent amount of his bully pulpit to that issue.
In fact, that's probably been his signature contribution to
the
black community.
Okay, beyond, people should read this piece by Gene Rivers about his prescription for getting out of the wilderness here. What should Barack Obama do? Or Deval Patrick is also a black governor. He's going to be here tomorrow at noon. Let's stay with him. What is he not doing that he should be doing, Deval Patrick?
I would hope that Governor Patrick would use his office to address the disproportionate impact of this on black girls in view of the fact that he has two of his own. His two children are young black women.
Yep.
One would hope that he would say, you know, I don't know whether Gene Rivers is getting hot and bothered about. It's a big deal. You know, Gene, he gets worked up, right? But that said, if there is evidence, and I cite the data here just in terms of the increase of black girls getting involved in criminal activity, I would think that the first black governor, and I'm not criticizing the governor at all, would say, what are the numbers? What are the facts? Why is this happening? And what can be done?
According to the FBI, writes Gene Rivers, between 96 and 2005, the number of girls arrested for simple assault increased by 24%, while the figures for males decreased by 4.1%.
Gene, you got daughters?
Yes. Yes, I do.
They're not in jail, we presume.
No, that's good. No.
So because you But one thing about
Stay on this for a second. What do you do as a father? What do you do to ensure that your girls don't get involved in the same stuff?
We joked about this a couple of weeks ago. We were talking about what you let your kids do.
Mm-hmm.
We chaperoned our children everywhere. When a young boy said he wanted to come talk to my daughter, my wife and I went and interviewed his parents.
I said, is that a true story?
He must have loved that.
No. The true story is the boy said he wants to talk to Sojourner Alice Rivers. I said, who is the child? Who are his parents? Who are his grandparents? And we're going to go see him. We went out to
To the house.
We went to the house, said, I want to know who you are, who your people are.
How did the parents react to your presence?
They were impressed and surprised. And I said, listen, son, you're not going to talk to my daughter. Oh, no. Unless I know who you are, who your people are.
How does your daughter feel about it? I'm serious about this.
No,
how does your daughter feel about you doing what you did?
Sojourner understood my father's crazy. I'm good. Look, my dad is crazy. I'm good, right? So my father said, there's not going to be no stuff. I'm going to go see this boy. Boy, if there is anything sounds like a problem, I know where you live. I'm coming to see you. And it's not going to be a happy experience. And that literally happened.
My guess is his parents are moving after that visit, Gene Rivers, let me tell you.
Let's get back to this marriage thing for a minute, though, because Jim would tell me normally that's ridiculous, that I worry too much about this kind of thing.
You're absolutely right.
But what's killing
me... No, it's ridiculous to worry about it with Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt.
It isn't ridiculous. No,
to,
it isn't.
Why? Because they're role models?
Because it's an example.
Okay.
And the thing that you realize when you cover... the young single mothers who don't have an education, is that it wouldn't matter how much they were getting in welfare money. If you're a single mother in Massachusetts, I mean, unless they're going to get $200,000 a month, which they're not going to get, and you have two babies, you are in poverty forever. And that's why it's so important to get married, because a lot of these pathologies are from poverty, Gene.
It's about marriage. It's about marriage. It's about stable families. Now, if you're PC and you're like the 12 people that live in Frisco, Harvard Square... you know, two of them in Brookline, you can do what the hell you want. But if you live on the planet Earth, where the majority of us live, you need to be married. There needs to be two people need to be taking care of them folk and raising the kids. The kids are crazy. Do y'all watch
Look
Girls?
Look at Jim. He hates this.
I actually watch Girls religiously.
In fact, I watch Girls because Sojourner told me that's what you watch. So I watch the thing. It's crazy to me. The whole thing is crazy, right? But there's got to be families. The black community is suffering as a function of the lack of stable families.
Yeah, but Gene, can I say that? When I hear somebody say what you and Marjorie are saying, we need stable families, we need fathers who attend to their children.
Because we do.
But that is the ultimate truth.
I know I do.
I understand. I am white, and I know we do, too.
Okay, good.
Fathers need to take care of their children and take responsibility.
Fathers love your daughters.
Okay, fine.
Who sings that song?
John Mayer.
You think that's
John Mayer. It's a great song. No, I don't think it's ridiculous.
Yes, you do.
No, I don't. I think it is totally the right position. But saying something like that is almost like saying, you know, it'd be great if all of us, it'd be really good if all of us had great jobs. Well, how do you get great jobs? How do you get fathers to stay at home?
You stop
how do you
saying
get them to
it's fine.
You know, it's the first
stop
thing. That's absolutely
it's
right.
Fine. No, you don't want to go back to shaming people like we used to, but you can't
I'll
say
go back to shaming.
It's
I'm going
to
shame you.
To be having a child.
Who has said, what person do you know, Marjorie, who is when asked, has not voiced concern that a father abandons a family.
What are you talking about? People have baby showers now, and everybody's
really
celebrating.
Do. No,
and
they
there's
do.
No, there's no boyfriend or father in sight. And we're all saying this is great.
No,
in the black community, I'm sorry.
But it's the white community too.
Oh yeah, well, you know what? See, the white community ain't my problem because y'all got Army, Air Force, and Navy. Y'all gonna take care of yourselves. Black people have specific problems that we need to address. They need to be shamed. Black man making babies and run around the street. I'm sorry. Then they can make... Look, I was supposed to go on MSNBC earlier today. Mm. I had to go to Dorchester Court because there was this young person, fatherless, who was 70 pounds, 14 years old, and got a 40-member gang because of fatherlessness. It's insane. And then we've got young black girls throwing bleach on people. How much crazier does it need to be?
Was that a gang thing? Do you think a gang initiation?
No. We got crews. Listen, there are black girls driving getaway cars when guys roll up to shoot people. Up in Codman Square, a boy got shot. The driver was the girl. We're out. It's off the hook with a wire cut.
I just have one last question for you. What you mentioned politicians who you didn't hear from after you wrote the piece on Friday. What kind of in all seriousness, what kind of feedback did you get from people?
Rank and file black people in the streets. God bless you, Reverend Rivers. We have to do something. Yeah, good response. The piece was written to generate the discussion. That was the whole point. What do we do? Tito Jackson, Ayanna Pressley, Charlotte Gola Ritchie.
Okay, here's the deal, Gene Rivers. As I said, noon tomorrow, Deval Patrick is here. Say exactly the question you want us to ask him, and we will ask it verbatim on your behalf. Go ahead.
Governor Patrick, what might the Commonwealth do, and what might the black community do in specifics to address the fact that we have a growing problem? As a black father of two black daughters, what would be your recommendation? Did you get a chance to see the op editorial piece on Friday?
We'll hand it to him.
Okay. And what might you do in your position, Mr. Governor, especially where there are people that are prepared to work on this? It says it all. Black girls, bleach. Okay.
Right. We're on it.
I'm on my
Gene Rivers, thank you so
God
much
bless
for your
you
time.
Both.
See you next Monday.
And Angelina Jolie with six children should get married.
Is that crazy? Absolutely.
Okay.
But who would be the wife?
Okay. We come back.
That was Gene Rivers.
Yeah. Boston's 4th of July music and fireworks extravaganza is no longer going to claim the national stage. Is this a blow to the city or a long overdue wake-up call to what's happening? It's not really very happening. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH.
Whether it's a stroll along the Seine or croissants on the Champs-Élysées, Paris is a city known for romance. And Paris is one of four European destinations you might visit when you support Boston Public Radio before June 30th. Make a contribution in any amount, and you'll be entered to win your choice of a 7-day trip for two to London, Paris, Rome, or Istanbul, courtesy of Rick Steves Tours. But hurry, the contest ends June 30th. Enter to win when you give online at wgbhnews.org.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Newbury Court, a full-service residential community for persons over the age of 62. Newbury Court in Concord, Massachusetts. You can schedule a visit any day of the week by visiting newburycourt.org. And WGBH 44, Detective Barnaby and Inspector Gently use old-fashioned police skills to solve Britain's most baffling crimes. It's Midsummer Murders at 8 and Inspector George Gently at 9, Mondays on WGBH 44.
That, of course, is Arthur Fiedler and the William Tell Overture performed by the Boston Pops. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. This weekend, I assume you learned along with this that the July 4th extravaganza on the Esplanade will, after a 20-year run, no longer be telecast nationwide. CBS pulled the plug, though it will be, obviously, on television on Channel 4 locally. Some are bemoaning the loss. Some are celebrating. Joining us for this discussion is a woman who appears to be all broken up. That would be WGBH's Emily Rooney. Hello, Emily.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie.
Hello, Emily.
So
How are you?
So what's the deal?
The fact that this thing dragged on for 10 years or so is just amazing. That they
made a mistake.
Much blood out of it. I mean, it didn't used to be televised. And then CBS came in and they'd have people like Joan London hosting and everything. The thing was a disaster. It was a bore.
Very boring.
And then it got really, really ugly. Remember when they started doing that stuff with superimposing the pictures?
Landmarks.
And the music didn't match and then you didn't get to see the real fireworks. It was some other tape thing. It was just awful.
So you're fine with the end of this national thing.
And you know who else I bet you is fine with this?
Who's that?
Keith Lockhart.
Who is the conductor, as we know?
I bet you. He is relieved. He can get his own program back. You know, did you know that they did a complete rehearsal the night before, which they had to tape, just in case something went wrong?
No, I did not know
that.
Oh,
yeah. Every year they had to do it. And a couple times they had to switch to the tape, thunderstorms in the area, something like that. So believe me, he will be relieved that this thing.
Well, the theory of David Mugar, who is the big guy that supported this for all these years, is that they were done in by Macy's in New York because Macy's has a big fireworks display and it's on the Hudson River with all their huge fireworks. That's on NBC. So that's what killed the.
Yeah, I heard another story about
what
really killed it.
What is it?
Oh, come on.
Well, that was really David Mugar who's messing up. I don't know all the details of it, but.
Well, speaking of David
Mugar, he mucked it up with those superimpositions a couple of years ago. That
when
was
they
a
put
disaster.
The you talk about when they put the landmarks of Boston on the TV screen during the production, which was really fake.
As if it were real happening at that particular time, which it was not. By the way, speaking of David Mugar, who is the man behind this? By the way, if you want to weigh in on whether or not you're mourning, I don't understand anybody mourning it either, unless you're worried about the economy or something.
Go down there and watch it yourself.
877-301-8970. But if you read the stories in the Globe, it's as if there are a lot of people who apparently are upset or they think they're crowds are too big. Mugar, in the first story in the Globe by Martine Powers and Eric Moskowitz, seemed to contradict himself. He says, quote, its ratings have not exactly plummeted, but its ratings are way down. In the next paragraph, he says, we were a victim of our own success.
Oh, come on.
Wait a second. I'm not done yet.
He then
also goes on to say, without the network contract, it'll be more difficult for the show to attract the same caliber of star. And he then says, two paragraphs later, it's now a local show, which is wonderful. So obviously he's a little schizophrenic about the whole thing. I am with Emily. I think it's great. I couldn't stand whatever his name is, Craig Ferguson, who was doing the thing. It started an hour later, which I don't think is great.
Yeah, it's great. Better for families now that it starts an hour earlier.
Does anybody really want to be sitting home watching that?
No.
Fourth of July night anyway?
You feel like a total loser.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember one year, I don't remember why I was sick or something. I actually watched it on TV and I thought, how pathetic is this? I'm watching the 4th of July on TV when I could go right out, a half a block away and stand on a bridge and look at the fireworks from Brookline and from Cambridge. There's a million great places where you can see.
And also, have you read some of the pathetic arguments that real people are interviewed by The Globe? The two arguments that I learned. One, people are really upset because it's going to be more crowded because theoretically, if you're in Ohio and you can't see it on television, you're going to get in the RV and drive here, which is preposterous. And then somebody else is upset because they come every year from wherever they come, somewhere else in the country, and they're upset because the folks back home won't get to see.
Well, that's the only reason. If you're
if you're
an elderly person that lived in Boston, now you live in Chicago or something, it might be fun for you to be able to watch them and remember, 4th of July has gone by. But I think except for probably elderly people or people that just can't get there for one reason or another, who was watching this anyway?
It was a really stagnant show.
Horrible.
Unlike being there and seeing that thing in person, this thing was, it was just awful. And they had these, third tier people that were, singing and that kind of. It was just awful.
Well, this year they're going to have Ayla Brown, which is going to be great.
And
really?
Susan Tedeschi.
She'll be the best one.
She'll be great.
Scott Brown's daughter.
Well, she'll be better than most of the people they've had.
Yeah, she's local, and it will be fantastic.
And by the way, we do own this. This is our local thing. But the Mugar, despite the criticism that we've leveled, he deserves a lot of praise. He funds
this thing.
Without his funding,
those fireworks
there'd be
alone
nothing,
have to
right?
Be
great.
Millions,
a million bucks or something.
Millions,
yeah. 877-301-8970. So in the studio, there seems to be unanimity that no one is mourning the loss of the national television coverage. If there's anybody out there who's upset about the turn of events, give us a buzz and tell us why, and we'll try not to be unkind.
Well, we have an email from Christopher who's telling me that Macy's on the East River. It's not on the Hudson River. I thought it was on the Hudson River. You may be right, Christopher. We should check that out. But he said he hates it when the Red Sox are broadcast on the networks because we don't get to hear our regular guys. So there's the same thing here. You'll get to hear, you know, the local people, the local newscasters will be doing the broadcast. And so I won't miss it. At all.
No.
I won't miss it at all. I thought they looked really foolish in the last couple of years.
But you're both criticizing even TV coverage at all. Is that what you're doing? If you're from Greater Boston or you're from somewhere in Massachusetts or New Hampshire and you want to watch it on television, at least you have local anchors and local
people.
I like that. I mean, it's better to be there than not be there.
Yeah. Though they won't be encumbered by all this network stuff. I mean, I think, you know, BZ and Keith Lockhart and everybody are going to be thrilled by it.
Yeah, Emily and I, by the way, are renting a kayak. Yeah. We'll be out in the Charles. I don't think so. 877-301-8979.
It is on the Hudson, Christopher. I just want to straighten
it
out.
All right,
it's not the
Marjorie.
East River,
there,
it's
you
the Hudson,
go.
So there you go.
You ever seen that down there?
No.
And Washington's got a big – doesn't Washington have a big – or am I wrong about that?
I've been a couple of times to the Cambridge side, your hometown there, to watch the fireworks on 4th of July, and they're pretty spectacular from the Cambridge side.
Yeah, I'm usually in upstate New York, and – we'll come home. We'd go out and watch them, take a boat across the lake, watch the fireworks, come back. And sometimes somebody usually has the thing on from Boston, but it's not something that somebody sit there and watch it. You know?
Yeah, it's weird. And it's a very traumatic time for all the dogs. Yeah. Do I always feel badly for the dogs? They go crazy fireworks. They're about to have a heart attack.
The one thing I will say in defense of those who are critical of the decision is it is a bit odd, at least to me. The article says there were a couple of 5-year contracts. Do you not find it weird that CBS would not say this is the one year we want to have it? Obviously, it's the first huge gathering post-marathon. It's an opportunity to revisit Boston where there is national interest.
They should have.
Our people are going to come out. I mean, that is odd, isn't it?
Should have canceled it after this. Done it one more year and say from this step forward, we're not doing it anymore. But you're right.
Why do you think Keith Lockhart's so happy? Because he regains control the whole deal? Is that?
Absolutely.
How many times have you been there?
To the fireworks in person? Not many. I'm usually down the Cape. I'm out of town.
How many times have you been there?
Maybe once.
Once ever?
No, but I'm usually up at Lake George.
I've been three or four times. Yeah. That's it. I've never been, except for once, actually. I've never gone to the Esplanade. Yeah. I'm not going to get there the day before.
You've never gone to the Esplanade.
Are you kidding? I would get there the day before and
camp out every single year for the last 32 years.
Do you go?
I roll up a sleeping bag. I get there at 5 a.m. I get to the first row.
You watch them on your third floor window or something like that. That's what most people
do.
They watch out the third floor window of their house, the roof of their house, or the tree or something like that.
Let's take a few calls, see if anybody's upset about this, because apparently we are not at all. Sue from Hampton, New Hampshire. You are next with Marjorie Egan, Jim Browdy, and Emily Rooney. Hello there.
Hi. I'm not really upset that it's not being broadcast by the national broadcasting, but I am a little bit upset with Emily and their response to people who cannot get out and go to Boston to see it.
Why are you upset? What'd she say that upset you?
Well, that they live right there and that's no...
Marjorie said that.
It's no problem. It's no problem to, see them from the Boston area. But
yeah, I said that.
People who don't live in the area who enjoy it. And people who are disabled, older, can't get out.
The local people can still watch it. You just don't be able to watch it if you live in Chicago, which is sort of too bad. But I mean, you know, it's probably, what are you going
to
do?
I know, but you know what? If you kind of listen to yourself afterwards, the attitude was a little bit strong, I thought.
Well, not everything is televised. There's a lot of things I'd like to see. But, you know, I don't think they did this event any favors by putting it on television. It didn't have any of the, you know, sense of presence of that being there. And it was a terrible broadcast.
But see, that's the whole point. The people who can't be there.
No, but it wasn't any good on TV.
Sue, I want to tell you, I think Marjorie's attitude is horrible, too. Thank you for the call. Sue, we're going to take one more quick one here. Karen and Waltham, you're on with Emily, Jim, and Marjorie. We're talking about the non-national broadcast of July 4th festivities. Hey, Karen.
Oh, hi. Am I on?
Yeah.
Oh, goodness. Hi. Well, what I wanted to say was that, in my opinion, the show really became horrible when it went network.
Yep.
It became overblown, boring, just really horrible, and it took all the Boston out of it, as far as I'm concerned. And one thing that I think is a little bit of – might be interesting, a little bit of history is that I think it was before it went network, one year – there was a substitute conductor, and I don't remember who it was. And one of the things that he did was featured in the program the music of movie score composer Eric Korngold, who was a really wonderful composer. One of the things he was most famous for was the Robin Hood movie with Errol Flynn.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, my God, what wonderful original programming. This is great. He also did Cole Porter. And I feel like so much of the programming as well as the program itself just became
bland. It was bland. And it was. I agree with that. And Karen, that was a great call, and thank you. I don't know. I believe, as they say in Bill Bell, I believe in Keith Lockhart. And I think if you're right, and this puts more control back in Lockhart's hands or baton or whatever, I am.
By the way, you guys had the wrong overture going into this.
Well, which one was
yours? The 1812, not the William.
Okay, let's hear the 1812. Here's the. Look, can we hear a little bit of Keith Lockhart and Tchaikovsky's 1812 overture?
Yeah, now that's it. Yeah, that's it.
That's the fireworks one.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we're,
you know, it's great.
That for you, Emily.
Sometimes if you're on the Southeast Expressway coming in and out of Boston, you can see a great view of the fireworks, too. That's where I try to plan my ride up to Dorchester.
All right. Have we beaten this one to death?
We've beaten it to death.
No, we're not done.
Emily Rooney.
Okay,
definitely.
Emily Rooney, you can catch her weeknights at 7 o'clock, Greater Boston, WGBH TV, Channel 2. Thank you very much, Emily. Okay, up next we are talking to a classicist scholar turned chow hound, Raymond Sokoloff. Studied the classics, now he studies food and witnessed the food revolution from the trenches. His life on the subject is up next. Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
The ongoing debate over same-sex marriage sparks passion on both sides. Now a new documentary looks at the issue through the lens of the African-American experience.
This is the unfinished business of Black people being free.
We'll hear from the director of The New Black. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Safety Insurance, committed to safe driving. Safety Insurance would like to remind Massachusetts drivers that it is now illegal to text and drive. You can learn more at safetyinsurance.com. Be safe. Don't text and drive. And RingCentral, the business phone system in the cloud. Now with business SMS text messaging, voice conferencing for every employee, and Salesforce.com integration. More at ringcentral.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Long before the proliferation of food shows and whole stores dedicated to cookbooks, food writers at newspapers were the whole enchilada, so to speak. Raymond Sokoloff was one of them. Ray was the food editor at the New York Times, food columnist for Natural History, arts and culture editor of the Wall Street Journal. He's got a new book. It's called Steal the Menu, a memoir of 40 years in food. And by the way, Ray Sokoloff will be at Harvard Bookstore, the great Harvard Bookstore, tonight at 7. But first, he joins us in Studio 3. Ray Sokoloff, great to meet you.
Nice to meet you both.
So I want to know first, tell people where you got the title, Steal the Menu, a memoir, 40 Years in Food. The Steal the Menu part intrigues me.
Oh, I was the accidental food critic. I had never written about food at all, and they found me. The New York Times, you know, discovered me. There I was, replacing the great Craig Claiborne. I was 29 years old. And on his last day and my first, we had lunch in the New York Times cafeteria, an ironic place for people obsessed with food.
Yes,
yes. Let me tell you, and with the great Charlotte Curtis, the women's news editor of the New York Times, so I said, Mr. Claiborne, I need help. What advice can you give me? And he said, well, you'll figure it out. He said, but the only thing you need to know is steal the menu. So I said, what do you mean? He said, well, this was before computers and databases, and you had to have the menu because it had all the information in it. Imagine being on deadline and you couldn't remember what you paid for the pâté de foie gras. So there it is in the menu. So he said, you know, if you ask for it, maybe they'll give it to you, maybe they won't. But if you – if then – you have to steal it, because if they don't want you to have it, they'll be watching you. So,
now, one last question about stealing the menu, because I find this very fascinating. Sometimes they're on really like on a placard kind of thing. And did you have a satchel, a backpack? And wouldn't the waiter notice it was missing?
Well, mostly they didn't. And those big ones actually were pretty easy to work around, because they generally had a printed insert, you know, under.
Oh, you'd sneak it out.
Slide it, baby.
Slide it out.
Oh, okay.
And then put it under the table and fold it up. And hey, they wouldn't notice.
Okay. Ray Sokolov, before there was this plethora, you know, everywhere we turn, you know, there's food shows and there's Yelp reviews and all that. When the food critic in the newspaper was it. We interviewed Frank Rich a couple of years ago, and we talked about, prior to being the great political writer, then at the New York Times, how he was described as the butcher of Broadway. When he's in one horrible review about a play on Broadway, and it shut down no matter how much money they spent. How powerful were you? How powerful were food critics when the only place they existed was in the newspapers?
I was astounded, because I had come from Newsweek, where I'd mainly reviewed books, and nobody ever paid any I never heard, you know, from, you know, I had 6 million readers, supposedly, you know, it might have had an effect, but at the time, suddenly, if I said something nice about a restaurant, people would call and they would make reservations, you know, weeks ahead. I had this vision of them all putting on their suede hot pants and getting in their Cadillacs and driving down and lining up and screaming at each other, demanding service. I mean, it was insane.
What if you trashed a restaurant? What if you said the food just there doesn't cut it?
Well, it wouldn't have a positive effect.
Did you destroy? I mean, were businesses destroyed? I mean, I always wonder about somebody who does what you used to do. You may cover this in your book. Do you have moral compunctions about telling the truth when the truth may have an impact on, for example, a family Chinese restaurant in lower Manhattan or that sort of thing?
We didn't review too many places that were that fragile in the first place, but you had, once you were doing, if you had a reason for doing it, then, you know, I mean, it's like any other kind of journalist, you do, in fact, bring the truth forward. And I did have misgivings from time to time. But the worst part was you'd review something that was very good and it would fold anyway. And that made you feel really terrible.
You have a whole big section in your book. I'm going to mispronounce it. The L-U-T-E, Lutèce. Okay, good. Thank you. I was going to mispronounce it. The famous French restaurant in New York. Now, you devoted a lot of time to that. Why?
Well, it was the most important review that I wrote while I was there, because it was kind of a cause for me. They were clearly the best restaurant in America, and they hadn't gotten the top billing. They were kind of an open secret for people who really liked food, but they didn't fit the mold. Because they hadn't worked for the man who created the iconic French luxury restaurant, Le Pavillon, and the owner was a French Jew, and the chef was an Alsatian with a German accent. So the kind of person, I mean, the whole New York high-end restaurant world was built around seating. I mean, it wasn't so much the food, but if you went to La Caravelle, you wanted to sit right at the door. Town & Country magazine did a seating chart of those restaurants, showing where famous people sat in them.
Wow.
And they all wanted to be toward the front so they'd be seen by other people coming in. So that was the, I thought, corrupt basis for celebrity in the New York restaurant world when I got into that job. And here was Lutèce with, you know, not the right sort of person running it. But it was great. And it was really like a French restaurant. I'd been a correspondent for Newsweek in Paris, and I kept seeing a mismatch between the reality of France and the kind of snobbish, out-of-dateness of the New York restaurant scene, and here was the one place that had it all.
But it became hugely famous. I mean, I've heard it for years. I mean, it was one of the big—eventually it did get that fame.
Immediately this review, actually.
Immediately.
That's the voice of Ray Sokoloff. He was the former food editor of the New York Times in the 70s. He's got a brand new book, Steal the Menu, a memoir of 40 years in food. Did I read in the last couple of weeks when I was reading about your book, did you get canned because of a review?
It's in the book.
It was Abe Rosenthal? Is that who the boss was?
Mr. Rosenthal was...
Excuse me, Mr. Rosenthal, yes.
Was the... his title then was managing editor.
Okay.
He became executive editor. Anyway, he ran the daily newspaper. I reported ultimately to him through Ms. Curtis, and it was clear I was trying to get out of there. This is my story. because I had, I was not in my own mind a food writer, and I had taken this job kind of on a dare with myself. It was so preposterous that I was being hired to do this in the first place. I got more informed spending 36 hours a day thinking about nothing but food once I was hired. But still, my deal with myself was I'd stay for 3 years if I really liked it and two if it wasn't working out. And from my point of view, I had done what I wanted to do, and I really didn't like the situation for a variety of reasons.
So what's his side of the story?
His side of the story was it wasn't working out. And I think he heard that I was applying for work back at Newsweek.
But wait a second. Didn't I hear you went to some restaurant?
Restaurant that you said was great, and he thought it was terrible.
I heard this only 6 months ago. So
is that true?
Yes. The mystery of why. I mean, I have it on very good authority that Abe only that of all the people that he let go, and they were very few because it was really impossible to fire someone at the Times. I didn't have to leave, but I would have been writing about shipping news for the rest of my life. So. Of all those people, almost all of them accepted jobs in shipping news, but I was the only one who just walked out.
So I'm dying to know what you think. I mean, you began covering food back when, we didn't have this obsession. I mean, I grew up eating Dinty Moore beef stew. My children are total food snobs. This whole foodie revolution where people that know everything now about food, even people that are like 25 years old, this is fairly new. What's it about?
Well, it snowballed. It certainly existed in 1971 when I took that job. Julia Child had published her book a few years before that. When I was a student here, I used to see her on the Mass Ave bus in Cambridge. We shared a butcher. There's a picture.
Really?
There's a picture in my book of her with her butcher that ran in Life magazine. And, we eventually became friends, but that world existed, but it was a hobbyist world, if I can put it that way. I knew people who would spend the summer going to three-star Michelin restaurants in France then. But now, with television and the proliferation of really reliable cookbooks for every ethnic sliver you can imagine, there is now a huge world of foodies and people who are very well informed about food because they can be.
You mentioned Julia Child at the butcher and I have a photograph. The first time I met Julia Child was at the dirtiest, crummiest supermarket in Somerville, Massachusetts, who's in line right in front of me with all her produce and things, but the great Julia Child. It was unbelievable. Hey, by the way, again, this is Ray Sokoloff, former food editor of the New York Times. I have one last question for you. I was in New York roughly at the time you were there, Ray, and every year the food critic, I want to know if it happened with you, would go, I think, to Paris, to the most expensive restaurant. I'm going to get this slightly wrong, so you'll correct me. Have a dinner for, $4,000 or some obscene amount of thing and then write about it on the front page of the Times. You're looking at me like that's from a different generation.
No,
do you know what I'm talking about?
I do, but it's a specific event, actually.
Oh, what is it? What is it?
Claiborne won a prize.
Your predecessor.
Craig and Pierre Frenet, who...
Oh, right.
...went to this dinner in Paris in the 70s, and they had $1,000 to spend on dinner, which was a gigantic amount then. And so it was created for them by a restaurateur named Denis, and then it was huge. There was an avalanche of criticism when, children are dying all over the third world, and you spend $1,000 on dinner. with things like, you know what oysters are in the chicken, the little things in the back.
No.
They're when the next time you have a chicken back, yeah, or from a roast chicken,
yeah,
you look in the small of the back and there's one on each side and they're about this large and they're called in English oysters and in French solilès. Fools leave them there. And they had a dish completely made up of dozens of these things. Yeah. Throw away the rest of the
chicken. Last question. What's the best meal you ever had and where, Ray Sokolov?
The best meal is the last good meal that you had.
Ray Sokolov, thank you so much for the time. Good luck with the book.
And congratulations on a wonderful memoir of 40 years in the food business.
Thanks.
It's called Steal the Menu, a memoir of 40 years in food. He'll be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight at 7 o'clock, so please check him out. Ray, thanks so much. It's good to see you.
Up next, a man who admitted killing 20 people was on the witness stand today in the Whitey Bulger trial. We're going to talk to Adam Riley, who was there and witnessed the whole thing. Stay tuned to Boston Public Radio 89.7.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Marjorie Egan has been waiting all day for this conversation. One of the most prolific serial killers in America testified at the Whitey Bulger trial today. Joining us from the Moakley Courthouse to tell us about it is WGBH's Adam Riley. Hey, Adam.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Adam. Well, I've heard John Monterano, who has admitted to killing 20 people, described as charming and how he wins over juries. I find this amazing, Adam. What did you think of him today?
Well, it's funny that you say that. I didn't find him charming at all, and I don't think that the people, my colleagues covering the trial, found him charming either. What blew me away, and I think this applies to, again, a lot of other people in the media, was the totally dispassionate way he described killing person after person after person. You know, we spent a lot of time going through his roster of murders. He confessed to taking part in 20 for 8. He's never been charged, however. It's kind of grotesque. He's been able to make money off this horse if he led, but as he described all these people he's killed, sometimes trying to kill one person and nailing him, sometimes trying to kill someone and getting two incorrect people or more before he got the right guy, he just sounded like he didn't care. He didn't sound excited or proud as he described these deaths. He didn't sound like there was any trace of guilt. He sounded like a guy who was talking about, painting the kitchen or something like that. And I just felt like I was watching a textbook definition of a sociopath. You know, there was no evidence that he gets in any meaningful way the sort of destruction that he's caused over the course of his life. It was chilling gets overused. It's kind of cliche, but it really was chilling. And not charming, I would add.
Okay. I'm glad to know that. Did he get to the murder of John Callahan, who was involved in World High Lie in Florida that was a friend of his? Did he get to that one?
We didn't get to the World High Lie killings today. And honestly, I would be hard pressed. We might have gotten halfway through his roster of murders. I'm not sure if the defense plans to have him talk. Pardon me, the prosecution plans to have him talk about every one. But the hits just kept on coming, and he would talk about he shot a guy in the heart, or how he shot up a car and it contained the wrong person. And again, with maybe, one or two tiny exceptions, basically no indication of remorse whatsoever.
Well, the reason I asked you about John Callahan is John Callahan was a friend of his. They hung around together. They went out eating dinner and drinking, and they knew each other. And Whitey Bulger wanted, at least according to these books written about the two of them, Whitey Bulger wanted him to kill Callahan. And Monterano briefly objected and said, he's a friend of mine. And then he just shot him right in the back of the head.
Well, that'll be interesting when that comes up to see if his affect changes at all. But yeah, he didn't talk Callahan today.
You know, when you talk about we're talking to Adam Riley, obviously, from WGBH, who was in the courtroom for the first part of the Monterano testimony today. When you talk about the coldness of the testimony, the one line I had read from his direct testimony this morning before we came down to the studio was a line that doesn't fit your description, where he said, quote, "After I found out they were informants, it sort of broke my heart." What was your reaction to that?
You know, that came in an exchange in which he also revealed that his first son or one of his sons, I forget which it is, is named, I think it's James Stephen as opposed to Stephen James, in honor of course, Whitey Bulger and Stephen Flemmy. He had been asked why he or how he came to cooperate with the government. And, you know, yes, you're right. He said that he learned that Flemmy and Bulger had been at performance, that it broke his heart. But if you can imagine the sort of the least convincing example you can come up with in your brain of someone saying that their heart was broken by something, that was how John Martorano sounded today. I mean, every word he said, from that describing technical details of killings to describing his start working his family's restaurant Luigi's when he was a little more than a kid, everything came in the same really low, really deep voice, total monotone, thick Boston accent. He didn't sound heartbroken. I guess we all feel hurt in different ways, but I did not feel the grief coming off him when he said that.
We're talking to Adam Reilly, who was in the courtroom today for the first part of the John Martorano testimony. You're a juror. I know it's hard to put yourself in this place. I'm trying to process what you're saying about the coolness, the matter-of-factness of his testimony. Is it possible that that's what the prosecution wanted and said to him? Matter-of-fact is good because it shows how cold-hearted and vicious you guys really, really were. Is that reading
too? I think that's a terrific point. And I think that to the extent that that his testimony ties Whitey Bulger to these kind of bloodless acts of violence, and I think it could be an asset for the prosecution. I felt today like Bulger's name didn't come up quite as often in Martorano's recounting of all the people he's killed over the years, as I had expected it to. I'm not saying it was absent from his testimony. He talked about a lot of murders involving the Winter Hill Gang, of which, as the prosecution reminded us, Whitey Bulger was an integral part. But it didn't. It wasn't like every single time there was a horrific anecdote. It was pardon me, anecdote. It was traced back to Whitey Bulger.
Hey,
Adam, still got plenty of time to do that.
We only have a minute with you today. Yeah. More, but quickly, did the prosecution bring up the deal that was cut with him, or not yet in the testimony?
Yeah, in fact, we spent about, of course, today the first, it felt like half hour, maybe more, was spent on talking about the plea deal that Martorano reached that that has him testifying in this case. Also talking about the time he did. I mean, it's really insane to contemplate. At least it is to me. I'm just hung up on this. He did 12 years, and he's confessed to taking 20 different lives. For me, that's just mind-boggling every time I hear it. So we talked at great length about the allegations against him, the guilty pleas that he's made, the deal he entered into with the government, and how he came to be here today. And obviously, that's to keep the defense from pushing back when they cross him and saying, isn't it true that you're testifying in exchange for this? They wanted to get that all on the table, and they did. It took a really long time because he's done an awful lot of bad stuff.
Adam, we got to go real quick. Yes or no? Was he credible?
Yes, I would say he was credible. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Well, I have a quick one in 10 seconds. Did Bulger react to any of this?
Bulger was largely impassive. It's tricky in the courtroom. We can kind of see the back and side of his head. There were times he seemed to maybe glance a little bit toward Martorano. But the weird thing for me is you expect these guys to radiate pure evil, given everything that they've done. And instead, they look like a couple of sort of schlubby retirees sitting there in court. And there was not a lot of, I would expect, sparks literally crackling between them. And that didn't happen.
Hey, Adam, I learned in the Globe today that Martorano lives in Cambridge. Please get me the address so I can stay away.
Okay, I'll tell you, said hi.
Thanks.
Will do.
Adam Reilly, GBH from the courthouse. That was a terrific report, actually, on the first day of John Martorano's testimony. We'll bring in more of that testimony through Adam or one of his colleagues tomorrow. I am Jim Rowdy. She's Margaret Egan. You can follow us at BOS Public Radio. You can follow us on Twitter, of course. You can follow me on Twitter at Jim Browdy, Marjorie at Marjorie Egan. You can also find us on the web at wgbhnews.org/BPR. As I said, I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan.
And we will see you tomorrow at noon. We hope you're here.